From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, we tag along as Latino USA producer Sayer Quevedo untangles the story of his lost family.
I guess it's been a long time. And then my first thought when I saw that she could be this woman was that, wow, I thought, oh, look, she's been alive all this time and she didn't even bother to, like, look for me.
Sayer begins to make sense of the mysteries of his mother and the family she ran away from.
I think we may or may not be related. What was your father's...
My father's name?
Also, we hear from Black Panther actor Bambajan Bamba, who tells us about his immigration story and coming out as a DACA recipient. All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, our producer, Sayer Quevedo, is going to take us on a journey to untangle the story of his long-lost family. And we should mention that parts of this story might be disturbing for some of our listeners. Sayer's going to pick up the story from here.
And then after that, after Shane, Sarah, and Lacey, Gabe, Andrea, and Yoli...
I'm at a family wedding. It's the first one I've ever been to.
Perfect.
I'm surrounded by a small crowd. Cousins, aunts, uncles, my family, who I've only just met for the first time yesterday.
Perfect. Then we got Raiden. And then my flower girls. Okay, I need my flower girls. That's an issue.
My mom left home as a teenager and never went back, so I never knew her family. And my father was out of the picture before I was born. So until this moment, the only family I've ever known was my brother and my mom. I've always belonged to the small corner of the world that we shared, just the three of us. My family tree has always been this single splinter. I'm here at this wedding because of someone who's not here, someone who I've never met and will never meet. Her name is Alicia. She should have been my grandmother, but instead, she's a stranger, like nearly everyone next to me, waiting to walk the aisle before the bride. She's my family, and I'm only now getting to know her story. This story doesn't really begin at a wedding. It begins 4 years ago on Mother's Day. My mom, Maria, picks me up from my job. I'm a part-time busboy and part-time journalist at this point. The night before, she had called me and told me that she had some news, but she needed to tell me in person.
So, I guess, you know, I know how you and your brother want to know more about our family. And so I had this idea that maybe for Mother's Day we could go to your grandmother's grave. We could talk about her and get to know some more about her, because I don't think I've told you very much about her.
She's told me almost nothing about my grandma. I don't even know if she's dead or alive. The few details that I know are these. My mom's parents are both from El Salvador, but they met in San Francisco, California in the 1960s. My grandmother's name was Alicia. My grandfather's name was Jose Ignacio. She was 17. He was 37. They got married and had my mom. And then one day, my mom left home and never went back.
I told you very much about her.
Yeah, I didn't even know she was dead.
Well, I thought she was dead, yeah. That's been my working assumption, because she was so sick, you know, when I left. And I didn't think she would get better.
My mom tells me that she asked her friend, Tim, who's a journalist, to look up information about my grandma. And he's found something.
He didn't find a grave. He didn't find a death certificate. But he found this woman who lives in San Francisco. We don't know for sure if it's her or not. She would be 66 years old. She could not be her, and I don't know. But anyway, there's no grave to go visit and talk about your grandmother, because we haven't found it yet. If it exists, then maybe this woman in San Francisco is her.
I grew up in the Bay Area, surrounded by the ghosts of my mom's childhood. The streets she told me she had grown up on, the people she had left behind. Now, sitting in the car, her voice is shaky. She opens and closes the window for no reason. Alicia is alive, and she lives only a few miles away.
I guess I'm nervous because I'm scared because I guess it's been a long time. And then my first thought when I saw that she could be this woman was that, wow, I thought, oh, look, she's been alive all this time and she didn't even bother to, like, look for me.
I want to tell you about Alicia, about who she was, because she's the stranger in my family tree that I know best. I want to tell you about how Alicia and my mom used to dress up in matching outfits, how she used to make my mom play the song Yesterday by the Beatles on her little portable record player over and over, how Alicia was once the queen of the parade at the Fiestas Agustinas in El Salvador. I'm going to tell you instead about how in 1973, Alicia suffered her first mental breakdown. My mom tells me that story one day over the phone. She was 8 years old.
So, yeah, I had a crush on this boy who, which is why I think Rob Lowe is cute, because he looked like Rob Lowe, this kid. And I had a big crush on him.
This kid was a neighbor. He went to their church. And one weekend, their families took off together to Yosemite for a camping trip. My mom says that her mom, Alicia, had issues for as long as she could remember, but they'd always been ignored or explained away. By issues, my mom means, namely, that Alicia heard voices. During the family camping trip, it became increasingly hard to ignore that fact.
Like, she was no longer being able to contain the fact that she heard voices. So she would openly respond to the voices sometimes. She would listen to their commands and she would do stuff in response.
At one point, the voices told her to leave the group and take my mom to the tent, where they just sat. For hours and hours.
She brushed my hair, talked to me, it didn't make any sense, but I was used to it, so it wasn't a big deal. You know, it wasn't unpleasant for me. She loved me.
But the next day, the boy who looked like Rob Lowe and his family decided to leave.
And I remember at the time, maybe it was denial, but I didn't really connect it with my mom.
And the following night, Alicia woke my mom up.
And that's when she took me out to the woods, and she left me there because she wanted me to be safe, she said. I don't remember being particularly worried or scared. I just remember trusting her. The next thing I remember is just like lights and, you know, people kind of coming out and finding me. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the morning and how things seemed really different in some ways. Like, my dad seemed different. Everybody was really super stressed out.
But they pretended nothing had happened. The way my mom tells it, they came home after that trip and her father, Jose Ignacio, started to drink and never stopped. Alicia and Jose Ignacio separated a year later. My mom went with Alicia. But Alicia's episodes would continue. She would disappear for days at a time. And my mom would be left alone, or she would stay with her grandfather. At one point, she lived with her dad, who was still struggling with alcoholism. So my mom spent those years oscillating between different precarious home lives until eventually, one day, she couldn't take it anymore. And at 15 years old, she left. For a time, she would come back and visit family, but that didn't last very long. To me, it had always seemed my mom's life was split in two. life before Alicia's mental breakdown, and life after it. And it was the after where things became vague, where chapters seemed to meld together and details became less acute. I knew my mom had lived in San Francisco in an anarchist commune. She had traveled to Europe, partly to hang out with some cute guy from a Swedish theater troupe. And then eventually, she had ended up back in San Francisco, where she met my birth dad and had my brother and I.
I think we're lost.
Or we'll just go back to where we came.
Which way did we come?
We were crocodiles.
Yup, we were scared.
My mom once called us orphans of history. And I think what she means by that is that we've never belonged to anyone. Not to a place, an identity, a history. I've always identified as Salvadoran because that's the one part of my family's background that I know anything about. And even that's not very much. I didn't grow up taking trips to El Salvador as a kid or listening to Los Hermanos Flores. My mom, my brother, and I were all born in San Francisco. It's hard to explain the tiny world I grew up in. It was a happy one, but it's not one many of my friends could relate to. I still often feel like an alien, like I grew up in Earth's orbit, close enough to see everything that was happening, but far enough away to never truly belong to it. After my mom tells me that Alicia might still be alive, we don't look for her. In the weeks and months that follow, we talk about going to see her. I look up her listed address on Google Maps and spend an hour looking at the house. I click through that little timeline of photos taken of the house over the years and watch the weather and the parked cars in front change. But we never really look for Alicia. I go off to college. My mom is working a lot. We're busy. But we're also hesitant. My mom tells me one time that if it were up to her, we wouldn't be looking. 4 years pass. I graduate from college and end up back in the Bay Area again for a couple of weeks. I've just been hired at Latino USA, and I want to get all my documents together before I settle down in New York. So I take a trip to City Hall to get a copy of my birth certificate, which I've lost. I haven't thought much about my family or my grandmother since that Mother's Day, and I can't explain why, but when I get there, it occurs to me that if my grandmother has died at some point in the last few years, this is where there would be a record of it. So I ask.
And sorry, I had a quick question. So I'm actually, in addition to my birth certificate, I was looking for a death certificate for my grandparents, but I've
never...
When
did your grandparents pass away?
I don't know. That's the thing. So I'm like looking to...
Do you know if it was within the last few years or...
I never met them, so I'm just seeing if they died, if there's a death certificate or a record of them. Is that something that's possible?
I can check.
I have an Alicia Chavez who was born in El Salvador, yeah. But the person was 70. There's no other information on this person. A lot of the information here is listed as unknown. Like, all I can really tell you with certainty is that they passed away this year, and they were 70 when they passed away, because there's not really much else in terms of information on
the almost every box on the certificate has the letters UNK printed in them. Unknown. But the ages match, and so does the birth country, and in this weird way, what most convinces me it's her is the lack of answers on her death certificate. I've lived most of my life with questions about my family, so I'm used to unknowns. I guess I hadn't fully thought through what it would mean to get an answer, like that Alicia is dead. And now that I know, now that I have that answer, I have to tell my mom. Tell her that Alicia had lived just a short distance from us this whole time, that now all our questions might never be answered, and that it was our fault, because we had waited. I decide not to tell her yet. I search the address listed on the death certificate, and it turns out to be an assisted living home. So I call. A woman named Carmen picks up the phone.
What is the name of your grandma?
Alicia Chavez.
Oh, she's not here. She left here for a long time.
You know her?
Yeah, she lives here. That's your grandma.
It turns out that she took care of Alicia for the last 7 years or so. She hands me off the little information that she has. But like the death certificate, the last documents are largely blank. No next of kin, no last known residence. the documents only go back as far as 2011.
You know what? Alicia is really a very nice lady.
Yes. Did she remember anything from her life?
We've been asking her if she has daughter, or she did not say anything. She did not say anything. No, I don't know. I don't know anything about her life story.
I go online to see if anything else pops up under Alicia's name, but again, I'm met with unknowns. Name, birth date, and nothing else. One name does keep popping up near hers, Milton. So I text my mom and ask her if she remembers anyone by that name. She tells me it's her half-brother.
Who is your half-sibling?
Yeah, on my dad's side.
Is it weird if I reach out to them?
Maybe we should talk first. You can, you know what, you can reach out. Just know that we should probably talk. I should tell you. So you know history.
Tell me what?
I can't really talk right now because you have to go into a meeting. Right okay. Now. Like I'm late a minute for the meeting now.
Okay. I love you, Mama.
Love you too. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Until this moment, I didn't even know my mom had a half-brother. But it seems like the only characters in her stories who are identified are the ones that pain her to mention. I don't know whether Milton's absence from her story is a good thing or a bad thing.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
When we return, Sayer makes contact with his family.
Unbelievable, my friend. I mean, my skin is shivering right now.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, supporting the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and encouraging the U.S. Hispanic community to learn more about the benefits of getting screened for the early detection of cancer. More at noesperes.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, Sayer had just found the number of a previously unknown uncle, and he decided to call him up. Here's Sayer again.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Is this Milton?
Yes.
I think we may or may not be related. What was your father's...
My father's name...
Sorry to interrupt you.
Jose. My father's name, Jose, but he's gone. So is my mother.
Was it Jose Ignacio Quevedo? And was your mom Alicia Chavez?
My father married Alicia. That's my stepmother. But then I have a sister. Her name is Maria.
I'm the son of Maria Quevedo. My grandmother is Alicia Chavez. So
are you really? No. Unbelievable, my friend. I mean, my skin is shivering right now. She's my only sister. When I left for the service, she never called me. She never, she knows, she kind of disappeared from this world.
When I ask Milton about Alicia, my grandmother, he says that the last thing that he knew was that she was in a mental hospital. He knows just as much as I do. And my grandfather?
He's been dead for almost 7 years.
He's been dead for 7 years.
And then he asked me to take him to Osvaldo because he didn't want to die here. He had Alzheimer's disease, so I took him over there.
Did your dad ever mention my mom, like wonder where she was or say, you know,
The last 2 years before he died, he was kind of sick. And one thing he said to me, he said, I want you to take me to every other woman I met, and I want to ask him for their forgiveness.
Milton and my mom share a dad, Jose Ignacio. Milton is from a previous relationship. He grew up in El Salvador, and in the 70s, Alicia and Jose Ignacio brought him to the U.S. He was around 17 years old. My mom was about 10. My mom and Milton would see each other around because he lived next door. But then they saw each other less and less when my mom went to stay with her grandfather after Alicia's mental breakdown. Eventually, Alicia was committed to a psychiatric hospital, and my mom ran away for good.
That was one of the reasons I said, well, I got no family. I might as well go into the service, you know?
He went to Vietnam, and when he came back, his sister and his stepmom had both disappeared. The only one left was his father.
Like I said again, you know, it's just like in kind of a flat earth, you know? I never thought someone in my family would be looking for me. To tell your mom that that I missed her.
To my surprise, Milton just starts weeping. I want to cry too, but I feel weirdly numb, like I'm watching this all happen from the outside. That night, I call my mom to tell her about the conversation with Milton.
So you found him?
Yeah, no, I talked to him today.
What did he say?
I go over everything that Milton told me, that he left for Vietnam and tried to find her when he got back, that he missed her. I tell her that Jose Ignacio died 7 years ago. And then I decide to finally tell her about Alicia.
There's another thing I should probably tell you before I tell you anything else, because it doesn't feel right not to. When I went to get my birth certificate from City Hall, when I was visiting, I went and saw if they had a death certificate for either of our grandparents, me or Connor's grandparents, your parents. And they had a death certificate for your mom. And I got it. I got it a while back, but I just didn't really know how to tell you.
When did she die?
And I felt really bad. Last year.
She died last year?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like I lost my mom a long time ago. I just didn't think that she would have lived so long, you know?
Yeah.
I guess since we're telling each other hard stuff, I guess I'll just tell you my hard stuff. So I think I've been really clear with you that my mom's side of the family was really bad. So when we were living with my grandfather, the reason that I say that his family was really bad is because he was a child molester. I don't think I was the only one, but I was the only kid in the house. And it went on for a really long time. When my mom was around, she would protect me. But when my mom would disappear, there was nobody to protect me. I want you to know so that you know that I didn't keep you away just to keep you away. I kept you away because I was trying to protect us, you and your brother and me. I'm really sorry.
Why? You don't have to be sorry, Mom. You don't have to be sorry.
I was kind of the kid everybody forgot about. Like, I'm happy that you're finding all this stuff because I think it will give you an anchor of where your people come from. But I don't think there's anything for me.
Why do you think that?
I guess because I think I was my mother's. So when she disappeared, I disappeared.
In the days after I spoke with Milton, my cousins, Milton's daughters, start reaching out to me over Facebook. They even call me and leave a voicemail.
Hi there, this is Sahara, your cousin. You can call me whenever. I'm going to save your number right now. Just That's Daisy, your other cousin. We're super excited. This is so crazy. I just can't wait to hear your voice. Please call us back as soon as possible. Bye.
Sahara's getting married in 2 weeks, and they invite my brother, my mom, and me to come. We all accept. So the next week, I head to California to set up a meeting for my mom and her long-lost brother. We all kind of agree that Sahara's wedding probably isn't the best place to stage a reunion.
In a quarter mile, your destination will be on the left.
One day, while I'm home, we're driving around, and my brother, Connor, asks my mom if she's always known about Milton. She says yes.
It's not that we didn't know we existed. It's that we just haven't seen each other in a long time.
Why didn't you ever tell us that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel like I didn't not tell you. I just, there
it is.
You
didn't not tell us.
I mean, I didn't do, you know, like I didn't, I wasn't trying to withhold information from you.
Oh, you did.
Connor, stop being a jerk. Seriously.
I just, it wasn't an active part of my life, you know? Oh, yeah. Park there.
Totally, same.
What?
Connor, stop being a jerk. Seriously. It's not about you.
It kind of is. It's also about you.
I couldn't even hear what you just said.
Separation.
What?
Connor, what are you saying?
Nothing. I don't want to, never mind.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I did the best that I could, Connor.
Even though I'm annoyed at my brother, I understand him. I think we both still resent my mom a little for having kept us away. Maybe he feels like an alien too, like he was never given the choice to be anything but that, to understand what or where he came from. Milton flies into San Francisco to meet us. I arrive to the restaurant earlier than everyone else, mostly because I'm anxious. Milton arrives next.
How are you? You look like your mother.
Really?
Yeah.
We hug. He's nervous and asks the bartender for a shot of tequila, but this restaurant only serves wine. So we sit and talk, both looking out the window onto the streets to see if my mom is approaching. When she finally does appear, Milton is mid-story.
She would say no. She would say no.
He stops, turns to meet my mom's gaze, and begins to cry as he goes to hug her.
I want to hear your voice.
Maria, he says, I want to hear your voice.
Why did you do this? Why you disappear?
I can't answer that easily.
My mom looks in shock. Not scared or sad, just not there. Milton is overjoyed to see her and to relive the past. But my mom looks like she's struggling. I know what happened to her when they were kids, how uncomfortable and difficult it is for her to talk about the past. But Milton seems oblivious to this.
There's a lot to talk about. Yeah, there's a lot.
A lot.
Milton and my mom talk about a little bit of everything. Milton's kids, characters from their childhood. They talk about their dad.
I can't blame my dad for nothing. I mean, you know, it's not up to me to judge nobody. You have your own way of being. You do your things the way you want it to do. I see on some people the good things more than the bad things. So that's how I remember. So, you know, obviously my dad, he was Jose, el abuelo, he had a character.
When Milton talks about certain family members, I notice that he uses that phrase. They were a character, or they were something else.
My father was something else.
For example, Alicia's grandmother, who they called La Niña Chila. My mom tells me that La Niña was incredibly cruel, a sanctimonious woman who turned the other way when my mom was being molested, who pretended to have heart attacks to get their attention. A hypocrite.
She was something else, too. That's okay. Like I said, we can't judge anybody.
Oh, you can judge some people.
But
you can judge some people.
You can judge some people, my mom says. And I think it's her finally rebelling against the complacency of her family. The way they watched on the sidelines as she suffered until she couldn't take it anymore. You can judge some people, she seems to be saying, especially the ones who are supposed to protect you. After the restaurant, my mom asks if my brother and me want to see where she grew up, her grandfather's house.
That's the house.
This one up here?
That one straight ahead, you guys.
With the light on?
Yeah.
Huh.
I don't think my brother has any idea how bad it was for me.
I think he knew a little bit. I think he had a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like he knew.
It's funny because earlier today when I was thinking about seeing him again, like meeting up, mm-hmm. I wondered if he would say that. Like, why did you go away? And I was hoping he wouldn't. It was so lonely when I lived here.
Coming up on Latino USA, Sayer heads to Las Vegas for his cousin's wedding, and he discovers there's more to his new family than he suspected. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the May Family Foundation. Supporting college reentry, a practical semester-long program in New York City. Helping young adults with mental health challenges make a successful return to college. More at collegereentry.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, celebrating 70 years of serving the public. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/70.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Last we heard, Latino USA producer Sayer Quevedo had traveled back to California to reunite his mom with her long-lost brother Milton. Now Sayer is headed to his cousin's wedding to meet his whole family in person. Sayer picks up the story from here.
The next morning, I fly into Vegas and head to the wedding rehearsal. Milton, my cousins, their mom, and the groom's family are all there.
You smell like coffee.
I know, it's because I'm still drinking coffee.
It's the only thing I've managed.
I'm not sure what to do with myself after being introduced to everyone, so I sit down on one of the white folding chairs in the shade with Marta, Milton's wife. The wedding is by a lake, and there are turtles sunbathing on a rock nearby.
Yeah, you just kind of stand like right.
My cousin, Sahara, approaches me.
Entonces, como papi me va a caminar a mí, I was going to ask you, would you like to walk my mom down with the entrance?
Yeah.
Okay. Yay! Really?
Yeah.
We're in the wedding now.
Okay, cool.
I feel a little awkward at first, but honestly, it feels really good to be around them. I feel connected, even hearing about distant relatives. Like, that's our uncle. That's the town our family is from. I feel like I'm from something. I feel like a Quevedo. After the rehearsal, Daisy invites me to come hang out with the family back at the house. It's somewhere in the suburbs of Las Vegas. She gives me a tour. They've got a big backyard with chickens, a dog named Flecha. The living room is covered in family photos, and there's a painting of a waterfall. A soccer game plays on the television as Daisy and I and another cousin, Margarita, sit down at the kitchen table to talk. Milton watches the game in the other room. First, Daisy asks me about myself.
No, you gotta start with your childhood right now.
Start from when you were born, what school you went to, all that, how you got into the arts, how you
lived, your relationship with your brother, all that stuff.
Oh my God, like, I want my whole Wikipedia page.
I tell them about my childhood, growing up with my brother, how lonely it was not knowing any of my family or our history. It's nice talking with someone who gets it. Daisy tells me that she felt the same way as a kid.
Because in Miami, we felt alone. It was just us. It was just Andrea, Sahara, and me. We didn't have anybody in Miami.
We go back and forth like this for a while. We talk about our weekend trips, our moms, what kind of kids we were, the subjects we were best at in school. Even though we're obviously very different, I feel the sense of kinship that I've always imagined people have with their blood relatives. Like this unspoken understanding that we're bound together by something out of our control.
You belong to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Now.
No, awesome. You just didn't know, but you've always belonged to us.
Yeah.
This is the moment where things take a turn. Marta, Daisy's mom, is on the other side of the room washing dishes. She turns to us and says that it's important that kids know where they're from. And then she starts to cry. Daisy clearly knows what's going on. She tells me that their dad, my Uncle Milton, had a baby outside of his marriage to a woman who lives in El Salvador.
I told her, mi papá es un hombre que tuvo hijas y no supo cómo tratarlas. No significa que es un papá.
Daisy told the woman, my father's a man who had daughters and didn't know how to treat them. Just because he gave you a child doesn't mean he's a father. I don't have to wonder long about what she means. Daisy goes on to tell me that at more than one point, Milton was physically abusive towards his daughters and his wife.
He would beat up Sahara like she was a man. My dad's ex-military, so you should never touch your daughters like that. He would beat her up to the point where she was on the floor.
Jose Ignacio, our grandfather, had shown up at the end of his life sick with Alzheimer's after years of absence. And Milton had mistreated him, too. As revenge, Daisy says, for the ways his father had hurt him. First, for leaving him in El Salvador as a kid, and then for the years of alcoholism and neglect. Milton is still just in the other room watching TV. I'm surprised my cousins are telling me all this so soon after I've met them. But the more I hear, the more I realize that on both sides of my family, abuse has followed us. My great-grandfather had sexually abused my mom. My grandfather had emotionally abused my uncle. My uncle had abused his kids, and then abused my grandfather in return. It's only later that I understand that Daisy tells me all of this to warn me, letting me know that I belong to them, and then letting me know what it is exactly that I belong to. Marta, Milton's wife, comes and stands by the table. She reminds us that everything that Milton is a result of how he grew up. That the more we learn about one another, the more we'll understand.
It's if, like archaeologists found a little piece of bone and start digging, and she or he didn't know there was a huge dinosaur there, you know? That is same thing. And why this person is like that, we don't know. And when we start digging, we start knowing, this happened. I didn't know. Life is beautiful, yeah. And very complicated. Yes? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My mom and brother meet me at the hotel where I'm staying the morning of the wedding. I feel guilty, mostly because I guess I had hoped to have something different to share with them. When I tell them everything I've learned about my uncle, my grandfather, the abuse, they're quiet. Then my mom says,
I'm not surprised. It would be nice to be surprised. You know? It would be nice to be surprised and learn that, you know, he spent some time, made a commitment to not, you know, to breaking the cycle of violence, to parenting differently. And sad to hear that Milton couldn't figure that out too for his children. I'm sorry that they've had to, you know, endure that. And I'm glad to connect with them. I hope that they'll break that cycle. I hope that they will be different to their children. I can hold that kind of complexity that I don't think Milton is the most horrible person in the world. And I can see that there's some part of him that's kind and good, but it is also not okay. And if you think your parent did a horrible job, your job is to do the opposite of what they did.
I feel like after hearing about our family, mm-hmm. I kind of understood more why you left a little bit. Not that hanging out with Daisy and my cousins was terrible, or hanging out with Milton was terrible, or anything like that. Just more that, like, hearing the background and sort of like the behaviors that seem to have followed our family for generations. Like, it was a lot to take in. And I was like, you know, and this isn't even my life. This isn't even people that I've been connected to for that long. So don't cry. Anyways, I feel like it helped me to understand you more and to understand why you did what you did. And I'm happy that you ran away, because you're an awesome parent and you helped take care of us, and you didn't give us that life or force us to be around that stuff.
You know, I do love you. I have always loved you guys so much. I wanted you to be happy and safe. And I think my mom would have wanted that for you guys too. And she would have left you guys. She would have thought you guys were the cutest. And if she hadn't gotten sick, then she probably would have been the kind of old lady that wore high heels and put on makeup every day. She would have gone to all your plays. She's that kind of mom.
Coincidentally enough, that's the kind of mom my mom is. Whether she realizes it or not, she became the family that she had never had, for me and my brother. She gave us the childhood she was never given. She protected us in the ways that she had never been protected. When we arrived to the wedding, everything is still pretty quiet. We find a couple of seats and I wait for the signal to go back to join the procession. My mom, my brother, and me have agreed we won't be attending the wedding party. I think we're all just kind of ready to be home. When the signal comes, I head back and I catch a glimpse of Sahara in her wedding dress. She looks beautiful, with this crown of yellow and pink flowers holding back her veil. Milton links arms with her as she heads to the back of the procession. There are so many things I want to tell him, but this is not the time or place. So instead, I find my way to Martha's side.
And then after that, after Shane and Sarah and Lacey,
I know that I found something beautiful here, even though in this moment it feels damaged beyond repair.
Perfect. And then after that, Natalie.
I have not found the part of me that has been missing. I have not found out the answer to whether or not Alicia looked for us.
Perfect. Then we got Raiden.
Yeah.
And then my flower girls.
Okay, I need my flower girls. That's an issue. Okay, give me 1 second.
But I have arrived at something important, something that cannot be taken from me. I know where I belong and where I'm from. That tiny corner of the world that was built for just my brother, my mom, and me, where my story of the Quevedos begins.
Thank you so much, Sahara Quevedo, for taking us on this journey with you. We're going to end our show today with something we often do. It's a segment we call How I Made It, stories about creators and how they got to where they are. And when we talk about DACA and dreamers, so often it's framed as an exclusively Latino issue. Of course, that's not true. Bambajan Bamba was born in Côte d'Ivoire in West Africa. He grew up in New York City. He's undocumented, and he's a DACA recipient. He's also a working actor with credits on dozens of movies and TV shows, including a small role in the hit film Black Panther.
What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
Here's Bamba sharing his immigration story.
At the beginning, it was tough, obviously. You know, you're a kid, you only speak French. They put you in a Spanish ESL class and, you know, you're getting bullied for being African. But as time went on, I mean, I adjusted, I learned English, I watched a lot of cartoons, listened to hip hop, and I kind of became American. The most challenging parts for me was the bullying in school because I was African. And sometimes you would get jumped for your sneakers walking down the block. Damn, it was challenging because the only other person that spoke French in that school was another African kid from Guinea. And instead of helping me out, he was tricking me around the whole day. I would ask him, like, hey, how do I ask the teacher to go to the bathroom? And he would be like, yo, say, kiss my ass. That's just one example. It went on all day, and by the end of the day, we got in a fight. One question that I really had was, yo, where are all the white people? Because I was like, hold up, I see black people, I see Latino people, Dominican, Puerto Rican, but there's no white people at all. And that was always like a question, like, are there no white people in America? You know, my little 10-year-old mind. I I get asked a lot, how does it feel to be black and undocumented? And it's definitely a conversation that should be had because some of the challenges are different. Because our community, at least the black community, the undocumented African or Caribbean community, we're just now coming out and telling our story, announcing our status, and letting the world know that immigration is also a black issue.
I'm coming out as undocumented right now.
When I announced my status a few months ago, to me, it was just, I'm undocumented. Every time they talk about Latinos or the negative stereotypes, it really affects me the same way it would affect someone who's Latino.
Does it mean that I won't be able to be there for my daughter, to raise her, to protect her, to guide her? We really don't know what's going to happen. I don't want to think about the worst, but we just don't know.
There's a lot of fear in our communities, but at the same time, when there's a party that needs to happen, people are still partying, people are living their life. I reflect on my parents who didn't even speak one word of English when they came to America. They ended up in the South Bronx and found a way to make it work and found a way to apply for asylum, which is, you know, the most complicated and crazy application anyone can go through, and still thrive and still make it and still raise their family and still do everything that we do. America really has a legacy, and I like to say that the immigrant rights movement is an evolution or even continuation of the civil rights movement. I'm hoping that sharing my story is bringing a little bit more nuance and diversity to the conversation, and people are starting to realize that it's not only a Latino issue, but it is so much bigger than that. It affects everybody. One of my goals is to hopefully encourage, inspire, empower other people like me. Our issues need to be addressed, and we also have to be at the table when decisions are being made about immigration reform.
Our thanks to Bambajan Bamba for sharing his immigration story with us. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers are Gidi Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on the next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children and the vitality of arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.